How are you all this morning? Great? Good. It's wonderful what a night's sleep will do for us, isn't it? The plan for this morning will be as follows. I hope to review the years 1832 to 1839 in Catherine's life by noting the content of her letters in those years. In a way, as one examines the events of these 7 years, they can sound deceptively ordinary. What we see and hear is a woman, a zealous, loving woman, plodding along with the tasks and decisions of every day, the joys and sorrows, and writing about them to her friends and co-workers. I say the record can sound deceptively ordinary because the quiet subtext of all Catherine's letters in these years is the creation, the spread, and the deepening of the corporal and spiritual works of mercy, which is always the goal of Catherine's life. The first 2 years of the Sisters of Mercy were not unlike the beginnings of any organization that hopes to endure beyond the lifetimes of its members. Now, in addition to Catherine McCauley, Mary Ann Doyle, and Elizabeth Harley, the three who professed their vows at George's Hill on December 12, 1831, 7 of the women who had remained behind at Bagot Street received the habit on January 23, 1832. They were Catherine Byrne, Catherine McCauley's niece, Frances Ward, Mary Angela Dunn, Claire Moore, Mary DePazzi Delaney, Catherine's niece, Mary Teresa McCauley, and a woman named Anna Carroll. Unfortunately, and Catherine learned from this experience, she had chosen to have the ceremony private because another young woman, Anne O'Grady, was dying at Bagot Street. The fact that the ceremony was private angered a lot of people. Carriages drew up at the door, people banged on the door wanting to come in, and among them was Mrs. Carroll, the mother of Anna Carroll. And Mrs. Carroll was so annoyed that a week later she prevailed on her daughter to leave the Sisters of Mercy and to enter the Presentation Sisters, where she became a wonderful Presentation Sister who always retained great fondness for the Sisters of Mercy. A year later, in January 1833, 4 of those women professed their vows, and they were Frances Ward, Claire Moore, Angela Dunn, and DePazzi Delaney. Besides the loss of Anna Carroll, Catherine's cousin, Catherine Byrne, had decided to leave Bagot Street and to enter the Dominicans, and she did that on December 1st, 1832. And Catherine's niece, Mary McCauley, who had taken the name Mary Teresa McCauley, had thoughts about becoming a Carmelite. And so she did not take vows in January 1833. Later that year, she became severely ill with consumption and professed her vows as a Sister of Mercy on her deathbed in November 1833. On this first flock, a great deal depended. Many of these first Sisters of Mercy became the founding superiors of convents established outside of Dublin, in Ireland and England, prior to Catherine's death. Their names also appear often as the addressees and subjects of Catherine's letters. especially Mary Ann Doyle, Frances Ward, Angela Dunn, DePazzi Delaney, Claire Moore, Elizabeth Moore. I suppose now is the time to clear up the Moores a bit. And they're not easy to clear up. Georgiana Moore entered the Sisters of Mercy very early on. She came to Bagot Street in 1828 to be governess for Catherine's young cousin, Teresa Byrne, who was only 7 years old, and Catherine's young niece, young Catherine Macaulay. She left about a year later because of illness. She had a weakness of the lungs, but lived for a very long time. And then she returned in June 1830. Her name was Georgiana. She took the name and religion Mary Claire. That was fine, except she had an older sister who was baptized Mary Claire. Mary Claire entered in 1837 and took the name Claire Augustine. And she is the artist whose work you have seen in many venues. The only problem there is that Catherine always referred to Claire Augustine as Mary Claire. So they were blood sisters as well as members of the Sisters of Mercy. Elizabeth Moore was unrelated to them. Elizabeth became the superior of the Limerick community. Claire, whom I will refer to simply as Claire, became the superior of Cork and then of Bermondsey and then went to the Crimea. In this list also would be Josephine Ward, Frances Ward's sister, Teresa White and her sister Mary DeSales White, Cecilia Marmion, Ursula Frayne, Mary Vincent Whitty, and Teresa Carton. On this first flock, as Catherine sometimes called them, depended greatly the good beginning for which Catherine was always deeply grateful. As she later wrote of the congregation in these early years, in short, it evidently was to go on and surmount all obstacles, many of which were great indeed, proceeding from causes within and without. The obstacles in 1832, 1834, were not always big ones, such as the cholera epidemic of 1832, which nearly exhausted the strength of the sisters who nursed for 7 months all day in a temporary cholera hospital, or the deaths in February 1832 of Anne O'Grady and in April 1832 of Elizabeth Harley. It's well to think about Elizabeth Harley, one of the three who went to the Presentation Convent and professed her vows there, one on whom Catherine greatly depended and hoped to have her help in the founding of the congregation. And 4 months after they professed their vows, Elizabeth was dead of consumption. Or the death in 1832 of Catherine's beloved niece, Mary Teresa Macaulay. Or the decision in 1834 of Reverend Walter Myler, parish priest of St. Andrews, the parish in which Bagot Street is situated, his decision to close the Bagot Street Chapel to the public. Archbishop Murray had declared that it would be open to the public in 1829, but in 1834, Walter Myler declared that it would be closed to the public, thus depriving the Bagot Street community of income from the Sunday collection, which they badly needed to finance the House of Mercy. The letters of these early years also reveal the ordinary tasks that Catherine had to learn to accomplish. How to judge the readiness of young women in the House of Mercy to be placed in private homes as servants, how to provide continuing guidance to her three orphaned nephews, how to relate to Daniel Murray, Archbishop of Dublin, and his secretary, the Reverend John Hamilton, how to select suitable postulants, how to write a rule for the congregation, and how to correspond with officials in Rome to secure ecclesiastical approval of the Sisters of Mercy. In the beginning, Catherine had a kind of innocent belief that if she needed something in Rome, she could just write there directly. It took her a while to realize that nothing was going to happen unless she worked through the Archbishop of Dublin. Somehow she didn't realize that Rome had not yet figured out how to relate to competent, experienced women. But these were also years of laughter, instigated by Catherine's own marvelous sense of humor, as her poem letter to Mary Ann Doyle's Two Wounded Knees demonstrates. In the cholera hospital, the pallets of the cholera victims were very low on the ground, so if you were going to move from patient to patient, an easy way to do it with not so easy consequences was to move on your knees. And Mary Ann Doyle hurt her knees severely, and so Catherine wrote her this ballad in which she told her that her two knees had now become martyrs and they would be christened with the names Cholera and Cholerine. These were also years of supportive friendships, as intimated in Catherine's letters to John Hamilton, Archbishop Murray's secretary, and in those from her good friend Michael Blake, formerly a priest of Dublin, now Bishop of Dromore. By the end of 1834, there were 24 women living in the Bagot Street community. Despite the deaths of many whom she dearly loved, and despite the community's financial difficulties, the bulk of her inheritance now nearly depleted, these were years of growth. Moreover, and this fact comforted Catherine most intimately, the works of mercy to which she had dedicated her life were now in full swing at Bagot Street. As she wrote in December 1833 to Reverend John Rice, an Augustinian priest working in Rome and the brother of Edmund Rice, Catherine wrote to Edmund Rice, visited Catherine Macaulay and encouraged her to write this letter, which she did write. It's on a large sheet of paper folded once. Her letter is on sides 1 and 2, and then Edmund Rice writes a letter to his brother on sides 3 and 4, introducing Catherine Macaulay. It's one of the letters that's been discovered in the last 5 years or so. Catherine wrote to John Rice, "In this institute, we lodge and support distressed, unprotected women of good character and have extensive schools for poor girls. Of the distressed women, 772 have been instructed and protected." That's 772 women coming through the doors in 6 years, receiving some sort of increase in their skills. First of all, receiving safe shelter, and then being, with Catherine's immediate help, placed in homes or other establishments where they could earn a living. No wonder the community begged bedding and clothing from door to door. And no wonder Clare Augustine Moore later remarked somewhat peevishly about the period in 1832-33 when the sisters also ran a soup kitchen. She said, "There was soup to be made for 100, sometimes more, and they had to pass through the office down to the dining hall in squadrons. So there was work and dirt and discontent and inconvenience in the management of the House of Mercy." That's Clare Augustine, the artist. Had Catherine lived to read this passage of Clare Augustine's memoir, I think she would have simply smiled sweetly. It was the merciful care of the squadrons that worried Catherine, not the work and dirt. The sisters entered a new phase of development in the years 1835-36. A branch house was opened in Kingston, which is present-day Dunleary, on the Irish Sea, south of Dublin. And in the same month, March 1835, Gregory XVI confirmed the status of the Sisters of Mercy as a religious congregation. In 1836, two new convents were founded, in Tullamore in April and in Charleville in October. And in the same year, Catherine submitted to Archbishop Murray her proposed rule and constitutions for the Sisters of Mercy, which was a very thoughtful revision of the approved rule and constitutions of the Presentation Sisters. But the integrity of these public accomplishments rested upon many private sorrows and worries. What most grieved Catherine in 1835-36 were the deaths of two more sisters, Mary Mactildus Gaffney in June 1835, less than a month after her profession, and Mary Agnes Marmion in February 1836, as well as the illnesses of several sisters with tendencies to consumption. Financial worries also dogged the Bagot Street community at this time, to the point where a loan of £20 made a crucial difference. In addition, normal day-to-day activities required increasing attention. For example, the increasing need to find appropriate outside employment for the young women in House of Mercy, to arrange reception and profession ceremonies, to explain the requisites of the Sisters of Mercy to inquiring priests. Yet, what is most striking about Catherine's letters in 1835-36 is her ardent, explicit, even winsome affection for her sisters, manifest, for example, in her feast day quatrain to the novices at Bagot Street. They had written her a four-line poem asking for cash to buy the ingredients to bake a cake for her feast day, and she wrote a four-line poem back saying she had already anticipated their desire and had ordered a cake. Maybe she thought it was too much to ask the let them loose in the kitchen trying to make a cake for 25, 26 people. We also see her affection in her long poem letter about the first profession ceremony in Tullamore and in her playful letter to a Tullamore postulant in which she plots a future nonsensical club. This was Mary Delamere, who was one of the first postulants to enter Tullamore in April 1836. Catherine writes to her about July 1, 1836, in anticipation of the reception ceremony in Tullamore on August 1st. And Catherine tells her she looks forward to coming, and she hopes that Mary, now this is Mary as a postulant, she hopes Mary will get the key to the chapel door so that when she comes, they may have a good time, because she is determined not to behave well. She, Catherine. She says the Divine Mother may not like it, and the Divine Mother is Mary Ann Doyle. And what she plots is that when Mary Ann Doyle and Claire Moore, who will be Catherine's traveling companion, go into the chapel at 9 o'clock at night, they will lock them in. And that will leave the rest of them free to play during the night, and they'll go to bed when they feel like it. And they will have put the clock out of order, so they will rise when they feel like it. And they will have a nonsensical club. And Catherine will be president, and Mary can be vice president, and someone else will be professor of folly. Sometimes Sisters of Mercy ask why we didn't learn more about Catherine McCauley in our novitiates. Any knowledgeable, sensible director of novices would know it would have been dangerous for us to have known more about Catherine McCauley in the novitiate. In a poem that Catherine wrote years later to Mary Ann Beckett, and you have it, but you don't need to look at it now, Catherine explained the relief and pleasure she found in composing verses. She says, in part, when not far removed from life's earliest stage, at rhyming I never could stop, and beginning to feel the pressure of age, I lean on it now as a prop. It affords some support and help on the way, recalling the days of my youth, in which 'twas my pastime, my folly, my play, and so it is still in good truth. That the autograph of that poem is in the Melbourne Archives, which is a great treasure to have here. In this poem, Catherine admits that she is a hack. Nonetheless, her often anapestic doggerels brought joy to their recipients as well as a prop to their author. In this and many other ways revealed in her letters, Catherine deflated her role as Mother Superior, a title which she had reluctantly accepted in December 1831 only at Archbishop Murray's insistence, and which she never used of herself, except in one official letter to Rome. As the Carlo Navas Annalist would record in 1839, the most amiable trait in her character, that is Catherine's character, which we believed we discerned, was a total absence of everything in her manner telling, I am the foundress. In January 1837, Catherine, at age 58, began an intense year of emotionally oscillating experiences that would have broken the grip of a woman less confident in the strength and providence of God. On January 23rd, Archbishop Murray approved, with mostly slight revisions, her draft of the rule and constitutions. On January 25th, four young women at Bagot Street professed their religious vows, including Ursula Frayne, who would one day take the congregation to Newfoundland and bring it here to Australia. On February 9th, Mary Veronica Ellen Corrigan, an orphan who had lived with Catherine since she was a child, died of virulent typhus just 2 weeks after her profession. On February 17th, Mary Rose Lube professed her vows on her deathbed and died of consumption 3 weeks later. On April 10th, Catherine led a party to found a new convent of mercy in Carlo, choosing as the new superior one of her most helpful companions at Bagot Street, Frances Ward. Sometime before June 7th, the unjust controversy over payment of the building costs for the poor school in Kingston escalated. The parish priest reneging on his promises of financial help. On June 30th, the typhus epidemic still raging, Mary Aloysius Thorpe, a novice, died at Bagot Street. The next day, at a ceremony that could not be postponed, 4 women professed their vows and 2 received the habit. And on July 5th, Catherine, Mary Claire Moore, and the founding party embarked by steamer for Cork to establish a new convent of mercy. This series of events alone would justify the fatigue that led Catherine to write from Dublin on July 27th. I am weary of all my traveling, and this morning I fell down the second flight of stairs. Catherine returned early from Cork, not staying her usual full month, because she was sent for, as she said. 2 weeks later, on August 8th, she wrote to her good friend, Reverend Andrew Fitzgerald, Dominican and president of Carlo College. "We feel just now as if all the house was dead. On the previous night, just before midnight, her second beloved niece and godchild, young Catherine McCauley, age 18, had died of consumption, her aunt at her bedside. The full pain of this human loss, Catherine never directly expressed. All in all, 1837 was not an easy year. The journeys to and from Carlo and Cork were demanding enough. The mail coach to Carlo taking 6 hours each way, and the steamer to Cork a full night by boat, or 2 days if one traveled by land. Gone now as well was the daily assistance of Frances Ward and Claire Moore, even as the unjust transaction in Kingston was heating up. Moreover, in the first 8 months of 1837, 8 young women entered the Dublin community, all needing Catherine's special guidance and instruction. But the heaviest toll on her mind and heart during these months was the deaths of the 4 young sisters. Years later, Claire Augustine Moore wrote, "I believe the greatest trial of all to her were the frequent deaths of the sisters. While she preserved her health, she had a great awe or even fear of death, and she never saw the approach of a sister's death or spoke of one who had died without great emotion. She had a really tender affection for us." The last months of 1837 were a very painful period in Catherine's life for a different reason. In September, a deep conflict arose between her and Dr. Walter Myler, parish priest of St. Andrews, over his unwillingness to assign a regular chaplain to serve the sacramental needs of the homeless women and girls in the House of Mercy. This unwarranted abuse of church authority, to quote Catherine's friend, Dr. Andrew Fitzgerald, caused Catherine more anguish than the saintly death in October of Mary de Chantal McCann, the fifth sister to die in 1837, or the pain she suffered in November when she broke her left arm, severely injuring the sinews of her wrist in a fall downstairs while visiting the sisters in Kingston. She made light of her broken arm, and she was consoled by the memory of Mary de Chantal's holiness. But the injustice of the chaplaincy controversy was a new kind of suffering for her. It was assuaged only by prayer, effort on her part, and the support and counsel of friends. The year 1837 also ended in worry about the stability of the Charleville community, especially about the poor of Charleville, for whose sake the community had in fact been established. In the first 3 months of 1838, Catherine's energies were also directed elsewhere. Selecting employment for numerous women and girls in the House of Mercy, she noted in January 1838, 20 went out to situations this week and 20 more came in. It's an amazing turnover. Consoling the Carlow community after the sudden death in February of Kate Coffey, a postulant who suffered a hemorrhage in her lungs after a fall on the ice. Arranging a speaker for the charity sermon, planning for a new branch house in Booterstown. In the midst of these activities, Catherine's lightheartedness nonetheless overflowed in a wonderfully humorous letter chastising her good friend, Reverend James Maher, for not staying to eat the breakfast she had prepared for him at Bagot Street. And in an equally humorous, poetic exchange with Mary Frances Marmion, one of Bagot Street's indefatigable workers among the Dublin poor. In early 1838, Catherine continued to defend the sacramental needs of the women and girls in the House of Mercy, but she was at peace. She saw in this controversy and in the Kingston controversy the cross of Christ, which we so often pray to be about us. Yet she still needed support. She found she could speak with James Maher, as she said, with all the confidence of one addressing a long, well-proved friend, and such comfort does not often fall to my lot. In the letters of the spring and summer of 1838, Catherine remembers the road the Sisters of Mercy have traveled from 1831, as well as the human instruments of God's providential help. As she wrote to Andrew Fitzgerald on July 3rd, "I never can forget all the animating, lively hope that you created in my mind when we were rising out of nothing." In her mind, the community was still inadequate before the severe and beckoning needs of the poor. She wrote, "We are very near a stop, I should say a full stop. Feet and hands are numerous enough, but the heads are nearly gone." Yet she went forward in September to establish a new foundation in Limerick, asking only of Frances Ward, her very dear old child, as she called her, get all the prayers you can for me, that I may get through this new business as well as I can. Catherine was now almost 60 years old. There were 7 postulants to be guided at Bagot Street. Her always dependable aide, Teresa Carton, a lay sister, was ill and needed to be temporarily relieved of her duties. The community was receiving endless invitations to establish new foundations. Catherine spent most of the last months of 1838 away from Dublin, establishing the community in Limerick, the first since April 1836, the fifth in Ireland. She visited the communities in Cork and Charleville at the beginning of this trip and at Carlow at the end. But her happiness in seeing the works of mercy extended to some of the most impoverished children and adults in Ireland, overlay the deep pain of a seemingly sudden and unfortunate development in the Kingston controversy, the eviction of the Sisters of Mercy from Kingston in early November. Her grief for the poor girls and sick poor who were left behind in Kingston reveals her profoundly personal identification with them. She wrote, God knows I would rather be cold and hungry than the poor in Kingston or elsewhere should be deprived of any consolation in our power to afford. Two additional worries nagged at Catherine's heart in late 1838. Her 17-year-old nephew, William, Willie Macaulay, was going to sea, sailing from London on December 26th, without having come to see her before she left Dublin in September or after her return. They were never to see one another again, a fact she could not have known. In writing to her brother James in late August, Catherine had called Willie a spoiled child. He left Ireland resolved not to seek any greater evidence of his aunt's forgiveness of his youthful flounderings than he had received in the past. Yet a deep bond of memories and long-standing affection united them. Willie's extant letters from Australia over the next 6 decades speak lovingly of Catherine, whereas her extant letters over the final years of her life are silent about him, with the silence not of unconcern, but of unspeakable sorrow and regret. While she was in Limerick, Catherine worried about Bagot Street, in particular about Mary de Pazzi Delaney's reluctance to have her away from home. Lacking at this point Catherine's understanding of the need to support new foundations in their early months, Mary de Pazzi exercised, perhaps indeliberately, a kind of subtle control over Catherine's traveling that put Catherine in the position of justifying and apologizing for her necessary absences. A destructive hurricane swept through Ireland on the night of January 6, 7, 1839. To this day, that night is called the night of the big wind. The hurricane left hundreds of Dublin homes blown down and the windows of the Bagot Street community room in shambles. But the events that most shook Catherine's spirit in early 1839 were of a different sort. The need in late February to dismiss Elizabeth McGinnis, a novice, from the Bagot Street community, and the ongoing issue of the Kingston property and debt. In these two matters, she was compelled to act in ways that ran counter to her natural compassion for the weak and her profound reverence for priests. Miss McGinnis was, according to Catherine, acting in a most rude and unchristian manner. And the builder of the school in Kingston, through the parish priest, was asking for the £375 debt as determined by the court. There were no solutions short of formally releasing Elizabeth McGinnis from her very sizable financial donation to the community in return for her immediate departure, and trying to lease the Kingston convent in order to pay the debt. To Charles Cavanaugh, the community's solicitor, Catherine wrote, "I regret exceedingly being obliged to engage your time and attention so much." Yet, somehow, the prop of poetry did not fail Catherine during this period. In January, she penned a long poem about the opportunities of the new year to Mary Teresa Vincent Potter, a novice in Limerick. On April 30th, her feast day, she sent a playful response in verse to Ursula Frayne and the sisters in Booterstown, promising them, "A party will make your heart glad, a nice picnic dinner." In writing to Frances Ward in April, she thought of herself simply as your fond and most affectionate mother. Catherine always treasured the serene words of the now deceased Bishop Edward Nolan of the Diocese of Kildare and Leclan. He used to say, "It is my lot." Catherine saw the events of her life as the lot which God's providence offered for her embrace. In the middle of 1839, these events included the death of Mary Gertrude Jones in Booterstown, the completion of the addition to the House of Mercy on Bagot Street, with the need to reopen the poor school in the building, and the hope that the commercial laundry would soon be in operation, the trip to Cork in August for the profession of the two English novices destined for Bermondsey, the long journey home to Bagot Street through Charleville, Limerick, Tullamore, and Carlow, so that the English sisters could see other Mercy communities and their variety of ministries in operation. And finally, preparations for the journey to London in November 1839. Catherine spent most of the last months of 1839 in Bermondsey, London, where on November 21st, she and the founding party, including the temporary superior Mary Clare Moore, established the first Mercy Convent in England. During this period, she also prepared the large packet she sent to the Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith in Rome, seeking Gregory XVI's final confirmation of the rule and constitutions of the Sisters of Mercy. The weather in London was often rainy, and the Bermondsey convent cold, damp, and unfinished. Yet warmth and gaiety characterized Catherine's letters in this period. She was exhilarated by the reception of six English women on December 12th. She called herself Kitty among intimates. She teased Peter Butler, the parish priest, about the English stereotype of the wild Irish. She wrote long letters to Limerick, Cork, and Charleville, and gave free rein to her verse-making. Though problems had arisen in early November about the contract for the commercial laundry at Bagot Street, and she had confided to Francis Ward on the eve of her departure, I need not tell you all the difficulties I have to meet in getting away from this poor old charge. Once she was in London, she gave herself completely to the demands of the new setting, making clothes for 200 girls in the poor school, visiting with English nobility related to one of the Bermondsey sisters, and helping the new foundation in every way she could. She carried with her to London, or received there, for forwarding to Rome, the most extensive written expression of Episcopal support she had ever received. Letters of recommendation from Archbishop Murray and Archbishop Crowley, and Bishops Ryan, Blake, Kinsella, Murphy, Haley, and Griffiths, all praising the work of the Sisters of Mercy and recommending confirmation of their rule and constitutions. She probably did not advert to the fact, or if she did, she was silent, that these generous letters were a far cry from the complaints made by some in Dublin 9 or 10 years earlier. Claims that she was a parvenu, one of the unlearned sects, doing mischief by trying to assist the clergy. Rather, in late 1839, Catherine was deeply grateful. For her, these Episcopal letters were, quite simply, a gift of God, a sign she humbly accepted that the journey begun so long ago at the death of William Callahan in November 1822 had indeed been guided by a mysteriously benevolent providence in whose presence her own deficiencies were not decisive. In Bermondsey, at the end of 1839, Catherine felt the pardon and the assistance of God. In the strength of such mercy, she gave herself wholeheartedly to the foundation that, as it turned out, she would never see again. I want to reflect with you on these years, 1832 to 1839, and especially on one feature of Catherine's life in that period that strikes me profoundly, and that is her painful but persistent advocacy and prophetic witness on behalf of the needs of poor women and girls, especially in the chaplaincy and Kingston controversies. These two controversies can be succinctly stated, and then we'll talk more about them. The first was the protracted controversy between Catherine Macaulay and the Reverend Walter Myler, parish priest of St. Andrew's Church on West Lynn Row, over appointment of a chaplain to serve the 50 or 60 women and girls in the House of Mercy. And the second controversy was the unjust civil lawsuit brought against Catherine McAuley for payment of the £400 debt for the construction of the poor school in Kingston, the cost of which the parish priest, Reverend Bartholomew Sheridan, had repeatedly assured her he would take care of. In these two controversies, Catherine McAuley, who had a profound, in fact, even legendary reverence for priests, Catherine stood in the position of Jesus in John's Gospel, before whom the scribes and Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery. Like Jesus, in these two controversies, which covered the years 1837 to 1839 at least, Catherine cast a strong circle of truthfulness and protection around the sacramental needs of the women in the House of Mercy and the educational rights of the girls in Kingston. In the chaplaincy controversy, three priests supported her: Andrew Fitzgerald, Dominican priest, president of Carlow College, and James Maher of Carlow, and Patrick Coleman, a vicar general of the Dublin Diocese. In Kingston, Catherine apparently stood alone. In both cases, she suffered because she chose to respond to and defend the needs of the poor women and girls involved. Catherine did not in any sense enjoy these two painful controversies with clergymen, which she hoped she could call portions of the cross of Christ. And I think we can learn a great deal from her about the painful, unglamorous, frightening, the unsettling work of prophetic witness. I'm sure she would say to us, it doesn't at all feel holy or biblical or saintly when you're in the midst of it. The facts of the chaplaincy controversy are these. In 1829, Archbishop Murray appointed Reverend Daniel Burke, a Franciscan, as chaplain to the women and girls in the House of Mercy. That was a different role from Redmond O'Hanlon's appointment as confessor to the religious, first of all, the lay community and then the religious community. Daniel Burke was chaplain for the residents of the House of Mercy. He celebrated Mass for them in the convent chapel. He heard their confessions when they were admitted, during their stay, and before they went out to work as servants in private homes or commercial establishments where there was sometimes, in fact, maybe often, the risk of sexual or other exploitation. However, in September 1837, Daniel Burke was reassigned to accompany the new Bishop of the Cape of Good Hope to Southern Africa. And then trouble began. Walter Myler, the parish priest of St. Andrews and a vicar general of the diocese, who had already closed the convent chapel to the public in 1834, refused to assign a regular chaplain. That is, a single man, a single chaplain, to serve the needs of the women and girls in the house. He wanted the eight parish curates to serve on an as-needed rotating basis, and for this he wanted an annual salary of £50. A different priest would be on call each day, not automatically coming, and never the same person. Catherine wanted a single regular chaplain for the sake of consistency in counseling the women and girls, for the sake of developing relationships with them. And for this, she said correctly, she could afford to pay only £40 a year. A major reason why she could not pay more was that in closing the chapel to the public in 1834 and prohibiting a second Sunday Mass, Dr. Myler had deprived the community of income from the Sunday collection, which it badly needed to finance the House of Mercy. Moreover, priests were not permitted by him to celebrate Mass at Bagot Street without his permission. Reverend Myler persisted in his views, and so did Catherine. On December 19, 1837, she wrote a long letter to Reverend John Hamilton, secretary to Archbishop Murray. Her letter, though long, summarizes the situation at the time, and I would like to hear quote it in length. She says, "I am sure, Reverend Sir, you are disappointed to find our unpleasant business not settled. I wrote to Dr. Myler the day you were here. He called. We acceded to his will." In other words, she had initially said, "All right, I'll take the rotating chaplain." "Promised £40 a year. He appeared perfectly satisfied at first, then complained of the salary, but in the end said he would send Mr. Farrelly, curate. Three of who were present considered all settled. In the evening, I received a note to say the salary could not be accepted, and that even if Mr. Farrelly were satisfied, Dr. Myler would think it his duty to prevent him. In answer to which, I wrote as follows." And then she quotes within the letter to John Hamilton the letter she wrote to Walter Myler. So this is to Walter Myler. "Very Reverend Sir, I am sorry to find the salary proposed is not deemed sufficient, as we could not promise any more. We received a gratuity toward the altar, which is now withdrawn. The particulars can be made known if required. We are ready to submit an account of our funds and the expenses of our institution, where it will appear that we have not near £40 left for the purpose. Perhaps, Reverend Sir, you would think proper to add £5, which you give, and we might make up the remainder." She's offering a compromise. She'll go to £45. "I remain, etc." And that's the end of that letter to Walter Myler. Then she goes on talking to John Hamilton. "After this, I had another note from Dr. Myler rejecting the proposal, to which he added, 'I think I feel your friend, Mr. Armstrong, urging me in this decision.'" Now, this is 1837. Edward Armstrong died in 1828, 9 years before. It was known that Catherine, that he was a very good friend of Catherine, as we saw last night. Catherine goes on, "Sunday was let to pass in the same disorder. Our poor persons did not return home till it was late." 60 of them had to go out to a parish church. They probably went to St. Teresa's, probably not to St. Andrew's. And remember, these are women whom Catherine is trying to help to develop some self-esteem, some sense of a vision for their own future lives. But many of these women are women who were women on the streets, or women who who simply haven't enough self-esteem to guide their own lives, so they're staying out on the streets. She says, when I missed them from their Sunday school, my heart became sore and bitter, and I wrote a letter to Dr. Myler, which is proclaimed a threatening one. I will write you every word of it. And this is, she includes the letters. She evidently wrote drafts of these letters and then did the good copy to send to Dr. Myler and kept the draft. This is the letter to Dr. Myler. Very Reverend Sir, when I read in your last note that you felt as if my dear, respected Mr. Armstrong was urging you to your decision, I thought that in gratitude for the affectionate friendship with which he so long honored me, I ought to mention how he acted toward a religious community. The Reverend Mr. Wall, his predecessor at St. Michin's Church on Ann Street. Reverend Wall was parish priest at Ann Street, and when he left that, Edward Armstrong became the parish priest there. The Reverend Mr. Wall, his predecessor, that is Edward Armstrong's predecessor at St. Michin's, had been contending with the sisters in George's Hill about some temporal matters. When Mr. Armstrong was appointed, he immediately visited the convent, gave his most cordial sanction to their two public masses and a charity sermon if they required it. Not all this world could give would induce him to harass or annoy a society of women devoted to the service of God and the poor. It's probably the part of the letter that was regarded as threatening. And then she goes on, still in the letter to Walter Myler. We were happily at home in time today, in time for all our different duties. Hence, for ourselves, we ask for nothing. But our poor young women are still about the streets, taking advantage, to be sure, of the irregularity which has been introduced among them. I will make one effort more in their regard. I will endeavor to prevail on the sisters to accompany me to their bishop, representing that the chapel and the institute which he blessed in all ceremonial form, that's 9 years before, 8 years before, that the chapel and the institute which he, the Archbishop, blessed in all ceremonial form, carrying his benediction to its outer walls, is now under some kind of condemnation, that even a friendly priest is not permitted to celebrate Mass, that the Blessed Eucharist has not been renewed for near 3 months, that the poor inmates are deprived of the Holy Sacraments. We will show what is lost by the change that has been made, and that far from withholding the necessary compensation, we are promising more than we possess. This sad alteration in our once orderly establishment cannot fail to excite pity in a mind like his. If we have encouraged, she's still speaking to Walter Myler about Archbishop Murray, if we have incurred displeasure and drawn this heavy malediction on our house, we will, on our knees, beg his pardon and implore a renewal of his paternal protection. I remain, etc., etc. And then she picks up again, talking to John Hamilton. At 8 o'clock on Sunday evening, a letter was handed me from Dr. Myler. It began thus. When is your procession to take place? I should like to see the theatrical exhibition. The bishop must be apprised. Perhaps you may not admire the reception you will meet, for he is too straightforward a person to be caught by your juggle. Catherine continues, I read no more, and put it out of my power ever to do so by burning the letter. I must now be done with the matter entirely. I will attempt nothing more. The means that contributed to pay a chaplain is taken from us, and we are to be forced to promise what we cannot be sure of having. We will show you our accounts, and you will find there is no prevarication in the statement made. I have no one to appeal to. It is said that we all dislike the parish clergy, God forbid, and that we give freely elsewhere. Indeed, Reverend Sir, remember she's talking to John Hamilton, indeed, Reverend Sir, I should fear that God would be displeased with my ingratitude did I not declare that Mr. O'Hanlon, the confessor at Bagot Street, has been the most generous friend, and that all he ever received for his 9 years' constant attendance, often every day for a week, preparing for profession, was £32 in different sums from the sisters to get Mass for them, etc. In all, the entire sum, £32 in 9 years. The only apology I can offer for all this writing is that it comforts and relieves my mind to declare the truth where I trust I am not suspected of insincerity. The chaplaincy controversy dragged on for at least another year, perhaps two. In June 1838, thinking of this situation and of the Kingston lawsuit, which had been settled against her, Catherine wrote to Francis Ward, pray fervently to God to take all bitterness from me. I can scarcely think of what has been done to me without resentment. May God forgive me and make me humble before he calls me into his presence. A compromise was eventually reached with Reverend Myler. Catherine would pay an annual salary of £45, and he would assign a single regular chaplain. I have found no written evidence that Archbishop Murray intervened to resolve this diocesan dispute, though he may have done so. On the day of Catherine's death, Walter Myler visited her. And according to Mary Vincent Whitty, she apologized to him if she ever did or said anything to displease him. The Kingston controversy and lawsuit involved a similarly painful disagreement, this time with Reverend Bartholomew Sheridan, the parish priest where the Kingston convent was located. In June 1837, Catherine explained this controversy in a letter to Charles Cavanaugh, the community's solicitor. Dear Sir, this is Charles Cavanaugh, a wonderful man. Dear Sir, when we went to the convent in Kingston in 1835, I expressed to Reverend Mr. Sheridan a particular desire to have a school for the poor girls whom we every day saw loitering about the roads in a most neglected state. And I proposed giving the coach house, stable, and part of our garden with some gates, doors, and other materials for that purpose. Mr. Sheridan seemed quite disposed to promote it and brought Mr. Nugent of Kingston, a builder, to speak about the plan. Amos distinctly said in the presence of Mr. Sheridan that we had no means to give toward the expense. But to encourage a beginning, I promised to give all the little valuable things we had for a bazaar that year. Bazaars are part of the original charism of the Sisters of Mercy. So having stated that she cannot contribute to the expense of building the school, she says that she will contribute all the little valuable things we had for a bazaar that year and to hand over whatever it produced. We got 50 pounds, which I gave immediately to Mr. Nugent, though we were 6 pounds in debt for things got at Nowlands on the Bachelor's Walk. While the building was going on, Mr. Nugent, the builder, repeatedly said he had not any doubt of Mr. Sheridan getting from the Board of Education a grant nearly sufficient to pay for it, and always added, "I will only charge what it costs me." Mr. Sheridan, parish priest, also said this with full confidence, and whenever I spoke to him of making application to the board, he answered, "I am waiting for the account." The letter which I enclose to you, sir, that is to Charles Kavanaugh, says the account was furnished to me. It never was, nor could Mr. Nugent have ever, in sincerity, regarded me as answerable to him. Law proceedings against Catherine McCauley for recovery of the debt, variously estimated to be 400 pounds or 450 pounds, were begun in early 1838. In January 1838, Catherine wrote to Francis Ward, "Sister Mary Teresa," that's Teresa White, "is in Kingston. There also we find a nice little cross. Law proceedings for building the school, though we expressly said we could not contribute more than the ground, coach house, and 50 pounds from the bazaar. By giving that 50 pounds, Mr. Sheridan says, I am what he terms committed. And he has left me in the hands of Mr. Nugent." That is, by putting forward the 50 pounds, she is being interpreted by the parish priest as willing to assume the rest of the debt. By giving that 50 pounds, Mr. Sheridan says, I am what he terms committed, and he has left me in the hands of Mr. Nugent. I am hiding from some law person who wants to serve a paper on me personally, a subpoena, and sent in to say he came from Dr. Murray. They can't get her to open the door any other way. They'll say that this law person came from Archbishop Murray. I am afraid to remain 5 minutes in the small parlor. This has caused more laughing than crying, you may be sure, for every man is suspected of being the process man and kept at an awful distance by my dear Teresa Carton. They make a demand of 450 pounds. I suppose we must sell Kingston when Booterstown is nearly ready. By May 1838, the lawsuit was settled against Catherine McCauley in the amount of 375 pounds, and the pressure on her to pay the debt began to mount. In November 1838, while she was still at the new foundation in Limerick and the debt still not paid, the situation reached a crisis. The sisters in the Kingston convent were suddenly forced to leave it. Either because Catherine decided this, so the property could be sold or leased, or because an eviction notice was about to be levied on them. In her memoir, Claire Augustine Moore says, "The sisters had to come into Bagot Street with all haste to avoid being in the Kingston house when an execution should be laid upon it." It was then that Catherine wrote, in sorrow, to Teresa White, the local superior in Kingston, "God knows I would rather be cold and hungry than the poor in Kingston or elsewhere should be deprived of any consolation in our power to afford. But in the present case, we have done all that belonged to us to do, and even more than circumstances justified." Catherine had opened the convent in Kingston in 1835 as a place of convalescence for six sisters at Bagot Street, with no initial intention to engage there in the works of mercy. But as soon as she saw poor girls loitering about the roads in Kingston, she could not help herself. She had to try to provide a poor school for them. In the course of this controversy, she was called, and I'm quoting, "a cheat and liar" by James Nugent, the builder, and "cunning and clever" by Reverend Sheridan. Moreover, a letter of William Walsh, a curate in Kingston and later Archbishop of Halifax, a letter he wrote to John Hamilton, the Archbishop's secretary, indicates that Reverend Sheridan was thinking of selling the convent himself, which he had locked and which did not belong to him, to the Sisters of Charity. In the end, Catherine had to pay the £375 debt by some means. The convent was not leased or sold, and in April 1840, Archbishop Murray personally asked her to return to Kingston and reopen the poor school. She did so for the sake of the poor girls in Kingston, though financial problems continued to threaten this work of mercy. I have presented these controversies in some detail because they represent crucial dimensions in the founding of the Sisters of Mercy and in the present day refounding of the Sisters of Mercy in which we are engaged. It was not then, and it cannot be now, all public appreciation and admiration, if we remain faithful to the prophetic advocacy involved in the works of mercy, if we not only relieve misery, but address its causes. We may often be dragged into controversies and made to stand alone with our reputations and our virtue questioned. Even now, there are issues before us about which we can either speak or be silent. The various regulations about women and girls in the church, the treatment of poor people, homeless, malnourished people, immigrants, refugees, indigenous peoples, their treatment in wealthy societies and in poor societies those wealthy societies have exploited, homilies that do not inspire and do not sustain the faith of the people, the environmental rape of the earth, the unilateral, non-negotiating, non-communal arrogance and violence of my own country. And you can think of many other issues of injustice. This aspect of our following of Jesus is not easy. We would much prefer to be treated with public affection and admiration than to be condemned for what we do and say. We would much prefer to stay out of the struggles than to be scorned for our defense and advocacy of the needs and rights of others. There is no easy, painless way to do it. Writing in the sand is costly to the one who writes. Yet in the chaplaincy and Kingston controversies, Catherine McAuley gives us an example of the way to do it that bears some resemblance to the way of Jesus. We need to regard the suffering involved in giving prophetic witness as a portion of the cross of Christ. Jesus was condemned to death for events like the defense of the adulterous woman. By definition, prophetic testimony requires speaking the truth lovingly but persistently. If we suffer for our speaking, it is better, as Catherine said, to receive that suffering in silence. Feeling always uncertain about the wisdom and Christ-likeness of what we are saying or doing is an inherent and humbling aspect of the prophetic vocation. True prophets do not think of themselves as prophetic, but only as people who realize they must try to speak the truth on God's behalf. At one point in 1838, during these two painful controversies, Catherine wrote to Francis Ward, "Thus we go on, my dear sister Francis, flourishing in the very midst of the cross, more than a common share of which has latterly fallen to my lot. Thanks be to God. I humbly trust it is the cross of Christ. I endeavor to make it in some way like to his by silence." Indeed.